morning. We want to welcome you all to our hearing room, but a special welcome to students from James Madison Memorial High School. Would those students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and this court. We invite high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If they agree to come, they're sent materials about the case, and they may engage in some activities relating to this case. They come to oral argument, and after the second oral argument, they will meet with a justice who is assigned to talk with them. The discussion is on the procedures for taking a case and deciding a case, not the substantive issues of the case. And everyone is invited to join the students for this discussion. If any of you would like a summary of the case we're about to hear, the marshal can provide you with one. So if you'd raise your right, any hand, either hand.
After me. Both hands.
Raise your hand and the marshal will give you a summary. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. I'm Shirley Abrahamson. I'm the Chief Justice. And to my left is Justice Patrick Brooks. And he's the justice with whom you'll speak after the second case. And following down the line is Justice Patience Robinsack and Justice Michael Gableman. Starting at the other end, to my far right, is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. And to my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, 09AP118CR, State v. Allen Keith Burns. Arguing on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Burns, is David Carr. You may proceed, counsel.
I thought the court would introduce Mr. O'Brien, too. That's why I was waiting.
Thank you. You may want to raise that podium so that you are – no, it's a new poet. Oh, I got it.
May it please the court, my name is David Karp, and I represent the petitioner, Allen Burns, in this case. The issue in this case is whether the true controversy was tried, where the prosecutor told the jury that there was no other explanation for the complainant's victim-like behavior, except that the petitioner had assaulted her. The argument was made during rebuttal argument, which particularly put the defense in a pickle because typically they weren't going to be able to answer at that late stage of the game. And it wasn't just one comment, but and it was a very strong point for the state. The prosecutor argued, no one can suggest a reason, again, as to why she, that is the complainant, was displaying the behaviors that she was, that Dr. Huebner, that would be the state expert on the Jensen evidence, talked about as being consistent with that of someone who was sexually assaulted. There's no other thing that went on in her life at that period of time that would explain those behaviors. And that's just part of it. The prosecutor did not believe that, and the prosecutor knew it wasn't true.
Counselor, the grandfather was later convicted of sexual assault, but at the time the statements were made, he had not yet been convicted, correct?
But that's true, Justice Rogensack, that's correct. However, because the prosecutor charged Grandpa Keith, I assume he believed that, in fact, Grandpa Keith had been assaulting the complainant for many years before the prosecutor alleged that the petitioner did, and in fact there was simultaneous assault in December of 2004, according to the prosecutor's belief and his actions in prosecuting both of them.
Was it the same prosecutor for
It was indeed.
Them? And the same prosecutor filed the complaint against both
indeed.
Of them?
Indeed.
All right. Okay, thank you.
And the complaint was filed before this trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
And who put the grandfather on?
The defense did. Now, this, of course, is probably what Your Honor would see as my biggest problem in the case, that the defense tried to, so to speak, make lemonade out of lemons based on the trial court's ruling that they were not going to be permitted to present evidence that there were assaults by Grandpa Keith on the complainant. So what the defense did was to put Grandpa Keith on in order to offer the opinion that the complainant was not truthful. However, this theory, we all know trials are very fluid matters, and you have to often roll with the punches. And in this particular case, the defense did the best it could with the rulings and limitations that it had to deal with. But just because it did that, it does not mean that the defense abandons in any way the position that was contrary to the interests of justice not to permit evidence of the assaults by Grandpa Keith. And I believe Penegar does address this sort of situation. That is just because the defense sort of adjusts to the situation and tries to do the best it can doesn't mean that the true controversy was tried. The facts are that the prosecutor knew, or at least believed, that Grandpa Keith assaulted the complainant. And he's arguing there's no other explanation for the behavior. So he'd offered this Jensen testimony to talk about how the complainant was acting in a manner consistent with that of someone who had been sexually assaulted by a member of her own family.
Mr. Karp, if I might, let me interrupt you for a minute. I'm looking at this in terms of a trial judge, and I'm thinking about Section 90403, the balancing test, and looking at this in the light of the circuit judge, it seems to me that if he were to have permitted this whole thing to be opened up in terms of the grandfather and what the grandfather was charged with and the rest of it, that in effect there would have been confusion of the issues. There would have been necessarily a trial within a trial in regard to the grandfather. Now, how could the judge possibly allow that?
Justice Crooks, I respect your concern, but the thing is, it would have been in the interest of judicial economy to try the thing correctly the first time rather than be in the situation we're at now. In any case, I think that the fact that the trial within a trial or the fact that this would have created some sort of sideshow just shows that the evidence was not rejected because it was unreliable. It was rejected more because the court was concerned about time. I mean, we have to do these trials. We have to do them right. There's nothing else we'd rather be doing than trying these cases and trying them correctly the first time. So we have to try them right. And the thing is, if the defense is permitted at trial to say, okay, the complainant was sexually assaulted by a family member, points the finger at Grandpa Keith. We don't need the Jensen evidence. The Jensen evidence just supports, okay, she's consistent with the behavior of someone who's sexually assaulted by a family member. Here we concede that. We concede she was sexually assaulted by a family member, but just not the petitioner, not Alan Burns. That is, the Jensen evidence went also to the the method of reporting and the delay in reporting. And we have to remember that the complainant expressed a certain amount of affection for Grandpa Keith despite what she said he had been doing to her for 10 years before the accusation came up against the petitioner.
Counselor, if I buy your argument, wouldn't I have to also conclude that you can never put in Jensen evidence when there is a prior sexual assault? So the rape shield law would keep the prior assault out, but it would also then keep out the Jensen evidence, right?
Justice Rogenczyk, if I understand the question, you're saying if the defense wants to present evidence of a prior assault, you can't present Jensen evidence?
No, what I'm saying is if I buy your argument that you're objecting to the Jensen evidence and how it was used. So if I buy your argument and say, yep, it was error, the Jensen evidence should never have been admitted in this case because of the underlying factual context of a prior sexual assault, then this would be applicable to any case where the rape shield law is used to keep out prior sexual assault, but it also would keep out the Jensen evidence because the Jensen evidence focuses on the results of a sexual assault.
Justice Rogenczyk, I realize I'm stepping into dangerous territory here, but I'm not so sure that my main point is that the Jensen testimony was inadmissible. My point
is
that
it's inadmissible. It's whether it was an abuse of discretion to enter it and then permit it to be used the way it was.
I think my point is the Jensen testimony would not have been of much use to the state if the defense was going to concede that, in fact, a complainant was sexually assaulted by a family member. That what would be the point, then, of the Jensen evidence?
No, okay. would be the point of it would be the delay in reporting, and there are other things besides whether it was a family member.
But that, you see, that's a defense point, actually, because she's delaying reporting even further against the grandpa. She doesn't report the grandpa until 5 months after reporting petitioner. She's trying to protect the grandpa. So the defense theory is that she accuses uncle, the petitioner, in order to protect beloved grandpa. She's not so attached to the petitioner. Hasn't known him that long. Doesn't make any expressions of great affection towards him as she does towards the grandpa. It's a lot easier for her to sort of divert the blame onto the petitioner and to protect Grandpa Keith.
Why would she want to do that?
Well, I think that the Jensen sort of testimony explains that victims of sexual assault will want to protect often the perpetrator, particularly
the
family member.
I don't think the Jensen testimony goes to accusing a different family member to protect another family member.
Well, not specifically, but the general principle being that you want to protect the perpetrator, and one way that you can protect the perpetrator is to blame someone else.
Thank you.
You started out, counsel, with the with references to the rebuttal by the prosecutor. Did the prosecutor specifically identify Alan Burns? There's no other explanation than that Alan Burns sexually assaulted the victim?
Yeah, yes, Justice Preston, that's how I'm reading it. He says, there's no other thing that went on in her life at that period of time that would explain these behaviors. There's no explanation here for why she was acting the way she did. The evidence does, I'm skipping through the rebuttal here, there's a lot more, but the evidence in this case doesn't make any sense except one way. That during that period of time, when her uncle had the opportunity to sexually assault her, he did. So it sounds, am I answering your question, Justice? I think it's because, when we have a situation like this where the state is exploiting an evidentiary ruling, what I would like to have the court hold in this case is that where a prosecutor knows that something factual could be contradicted at the trial by something the trial court excluded, the prosecutor ought not to be permitted to then argue that that evidence doesn't exist.
But, counsel, the prosecutor, in these closing remarks that your client finds objectionable and indicative in his estimation that the true controversy was not tried, the prosecutor was referencing the facts as they were presented at trial. And given that, I'm going to ask you for help in understanding how a prosecutor referencing facts as they are presented at the trial. Prosecutors may know all sorts of things that are not provable in court. They may or may not be. And so the prosecutors, like every other litigator, have to fashion their remarks in conformity with the ruling of the trial court judge. And by referencing the facts that were made known at the trial, how does that lead to the conclusion that the true controversy was not tried?
I think, Justice Gable, and I think particularly public prosecutors have an obligation towards the truth and, of course, towards justice. So if the prosecutor knows...
Justice through law and the lawful rulings of the circuit court fashioning the proceedings of the trial.
And if there's a ruling by the court that excludes evidence, is it fair then for the prosecutor to say that it doesn't exist? My position is no. It's not okay. It's not acceptable. I don't see how that's a whole lot different than the prosecutor arguing that evidence the prosecutor has withheld doesn't exist.
Except the distinction that jumps out immediately is that one is pursuant to a lawful court order of a trial court fashioning the evidence and making rulings at a trial, and the other would run to misconduct.
Mm-hmm.
That seems like a pretty important distinction.
But it also seems to me like the prosecutor here was sort of too smart by half by arguing this, saying, okay, no one could present this evidence. It's the way the prosecutor phrased it, not simply saying there's no evidence before the court to explain this, but saying that no one could suggest a reason here.
So if that's your, if you were writing this opinion, you would say that if the prosecutor had prefaced his remarks by saying, there is no evidence before you to indicate that there is any other explanation, then that would be okay.
Well, that would certainly soften the blow somewhat.
Would it pass your test that you're apparently asking us to fashion?
It would be, the way it was phrased here, I would say that it's not okay, particularly given the circumstances here. That is, that the trial court had excluded the references to Grandpa Keith, that the Jensen opinion supported there had been assault by a family member, and I think it also actually ties in to the method of reporting, that is, with the complainant saying that due to what what the petitioner had done to her, she was no longer a virgin. And that was inflammatory as well. I think you have to look at the whole picture here, a hypothetical as to whether or not, under different circumstances, a softer argument simply to the effect that the evidence before the court does
not... I'd be more sympathetic towards that if it hadn't been your hypothetical. I think you said that if the prosecutor had said there's no evidence before you, members of the jury, to indicate any other alternative explanation, that would be acceptable. And I've asked you, basically, if the test that you've proposed is what you're asking us to fashion.
Justice Gableman, I think actually I'm in error, because that would still create the inference, even if the prosecutor said there's no evidence before the court, it would still cause the jury to infer that the evidence didn't exist. So
wouldn't that be a truthful statement, counsel?
Yes, but it would lead to an improper inference. And I think the inference is as harmful as the statement itself. Whereas this particular argument, I think, is much worse than simply allowing the inference. But I would, in fact, ask the court to hold that when the statement of the prosecutor permits the inference that there is, in fact, no such evidence.
Your position is directly or indirectly, the prosecutor can't say something that's factual that is contradicted by evidence that the trial court has excluded.
Yes,
that's the test I wrote down that you said. You stand by that test?
Yes, Chief Justice.
And the Court of Appeals said, let's see if I can find that language. This is in paragraph 38. We needn't decide whether it was improper for the prosecutor to take this additional step from arguing about Dr. Huebner's testimony and SB's behavior support the conclusion Burns sexually assaulted SB to arguing there's no other explanation. The reason that they're not disturbed about this, says the Court of Appeals, is that we are satisfied that this additional step did not prevent the real controversy from being fully tried. And here's the sentence. Even if the prosecutor had not expressly said there is no other explanation for SB's behavior, the jury would no doubt inferred this, assuming that they credited Dr. Huebner's testimony, given the absence of testimony that anyone other than Burns had sexually assaulted SB. So the Court of Appeals recognizes that even if the prosecutor hadn't said anything or hadn't said there's no other explanation, the jury infers there's no other explanation from Dr. Huebner's testimony. Because if there was another explanation, the defense counsel would have brought it in. But here, the defense was prohibited. Now, is it your position that this Polizzano evidence, the grandfather was or was not properly excluded? Or don't you care? I mean, when I say don't you care, is that not what you're basing your defense on?
On the one hand, because we're talking about the interests of justice, I think that it's not first and foremost. But the question is, too, because things changed during the proceedings of the trial, it might not have started out being admissible. That is, the trial court's initial ruling may have been on fairly solid ground, but as things changed during the trial,
changed?
Well, I'm particularly thinking about the statement by the complainant that the petitioner had had caused her not to be a virgin anymore. I think that that certainly created an inflammatory situation.
Should the defense counsel have been disciplined for the way defense counsel conducted the trial, putting on the grandfather to testify, believing that the grandfather was going to lie?
I think I see what you're saying, Justice Prosser. That is, if defense counsel believed, in fact, that that Grandpa had in fact done the assaults, was it bad to put him? I think he was limited by the trial court's ruling and had to do the best he could. And
well, isn't what's good for the goose good for the gander here? I mean, it's just an extraordinary set of facts here.
That's true. But I don't think defense counsel elicited from Grandpa Keith the testimony, I didn't assault the complainant. Grandpa Keith rather talked about opinion and talked about an episode where the complainant had said Grandpa Keith had supposedly caught the petitioner and the complainant together in a bedroom, and Grandpa Keith said it didn't happen. So his testimony contradicting some of the complainant's points didn't go specifically to the assaults by Grandpa Keith upon the complainant. So no, I don't think defense counsel should be disciplined.
What about the prosecutor? He put on this 14-year-old. She testified, didn't she? And later she testified she lied.
And I have to give the prosecutor benefit of the doubt because I wasn't there. I don't know why the prosecutor couldn't tell his witness, be careful you don't say anything about your statement to other witnesses that you were no longer a virgin. Because it's not true. He clearly did so with the witness that preceded the complainant. He was careful to admonish that witness, and in fact, that was done on the record. Why he couldn't do that with the complainant? Did this just slip out? For the giving the prosecutor the benefit of a doubt, and that is that it just slipped out. Still, it was a windfall for the state in this case.
But the circuit court found, I think, that statement was completely inadvertent and not encouraged by the prosecutor, and it was just an accident. It was not played up by the prosecutor.
Justice Prosser, you're right, but nonetheless, it was a windfall for the state and certainly contributed to the atmosphere of the trial and made the trial unfair.
Well, the point, there's several things. One, the whole concept of being a virgin and then having been assaulted tends to inflame people. Second thing is that when she says that, she's being untruthful about the grandfather, who apparently had relations with her way before the uncle came on the scene. So when she talks about this, she is saying the defendant was the first one. And that by itself is untrue. So the inference is that it's untrue on that. I mean, I thought that's what you would argue. You accept that.
I think that's one spin on it, but our position is it's not that the petitioner assaulted her secondly. He simply didn't assault her. He claims
innocence. I understand that.
Now, when she said this, wasn't she describing a conversation she had had with the previous witness?
Yes.
And what did she tell him?
She told him that.
No, I'm sorry. That was the question
posed
to her. What did she tell?
And that, Justice Gable, that just shows the nefariousness of the timing of this statement, because the jury gets all excited about this mystery statement from the witness that preceded the complainant. And so they get all interested in it. It's intriguing. And then, boom, she comes out with it. So you can bet they were paying attention.
But when she was asked about it, she was being asked to describe a conversation she had had with a previous witness.
Yes, sir.
Is there anything to indicate that she testified falsely?
Yes.
In that regard, as far as what her conversation was.
Because she said it was because of what the petitioner had done to her, and that was clearly untrue. From no one's point of view, did the petitioner.
That statement was not couched in terms of uncertainty of any kind.
The record clearly shows Grandpa Keith began having sexual intercourse with the complainant when she was something like 8 years old. And here she was 14. At the time that she claims that the petitioner assaulted her, Justice.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Karp. Assistant Attorney General Daniel O'Brien, representing the state of Wisconsin. Mr. Karp, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the court. The real controversy at trial was whether the victim in this case was being truthful when she alleged that Ellen Burns sexually assaulted her. But the question for this court, what is the controversy here? And the controversy is framed by Mr. Burns, as best as I can surmise from the various pleadings at the post-trial stage in the Court of Appeals and now here, is essentially that even though the trial court's evidentiary rulings were okay at the time, and even though I did not object to the prosecutor's closing argument, and even though the victim inadvertently blurted out a statement about her virginity, apparently the point now is that her statement about her virginity and the prosecutor's rebuttal argument somehow reopens all of those evidentiary rulings, even though none of those evidentiary rulings were challenged directly at the post-conviction stage or on appeal, and even though there was never a claim of ineffective trial counsel, and even though to this day counsel agrees that Dr. Huebner's testimony about the behavior of sexual assault victims was properly admitted. So in that context, we're looking at whether the child's credibility was sufficiently challenged at the trial. And I would point, first and foremost, to the aggressive cross-examination by trial counsel of the child, both, I believe it's the end of the second day and the beginning of the third day of trial, where he referred to a number of inconsistencies in various statements she gave to social workers, to police, to relatives, where he points to inconsistencies between things she said on day two as opposed to what she said on day three of the trial. And then he puts on her grandfather, who testifies that, yes, she's untruthful, she lies. And the prosecutor is constrained from cross-examining the grandfather about his own motives for attacking her credibility, very serious motives. He's facing a pending charge of sexual assault. The state doesn't get to bring that out. Then he puts on the girlfriend, who testifies as to the Christmas incident. This couldn't have happened because we were in our bedroom having sexual relations that night, and she was in the other room. This just couldn't have happened. That charge was eventually dismissed due to insufficient evidence. So, and it's not true that he could not, that Mr. Burns could not have brought out the allegations regarding the father. First of all, or the grandfather. First of all, there was an extended discussion at trial, pre-trial, about the state's evidence that this child indeed had two separate hymenal tears. which is pretty concrete proof that someone penetrated her at some point. The state could have put that in, but the trial judge ruled that if you put that in, then I will allow Mr. Burns to cross-examine about where those hymenal tears might have come from. It could have been the grandfather. I will allow that. The prosecutor chose not to delve into this very, I would say, compelling physical evidence. In the joint effort of really everyone to sort of steer clear of the whole grandfather trial, which, again, he had not yet been convicted. There was a probable cause determination and charges were pending. And then, when Dr. Huebner testified, the defense never revisited the issue. He never asked, well, Your Honor, if Dr. Huebner is going to testify, I want to be able to cross-examine her about whether someone else could have caused these symptoms that she's testifying about. He never asked the trial judge for a ruling on that, even though he knew Dr. Huebner was going to testify that the behavior of this child was consistent with that of known sexual assault victims. It would seem to me at that point, that's when defense counsel, regardless of what happened after that, regardless of any blurting out about virginity, regardless of a prosecutor's subsequent rebuttal argument, that is the point to say, Your Honor, we've got this expert witnesses. There's an alternative explanation. Someone else could have assaulted her. That was the point to raise the issue, and it wasn't raised. So he proceeded throughout the trial knowing that there's no other explanation in this evidence for her behaviors. Although there were explanations, actually. The defense did raise explanations about the fact that her mother had recently died, that she was moving all over the country, she had lost all kinds of school friends, and that caused her to act out, too. So there were other explanations, and that could have been brought out, and it was. However, that was the point. And the Court of Appeals is very careful to explain all of this. When you look at the Court of Appeals decisions at paragraphs 3 through 6, paragraphs 22 and 25, they talk about what was and what was not objected to, what was and what was not challenged on appeal. And by defining the issue for this court as whether the real controversy was not tried, and by not challenging the admissibility of Dr. Huebner's testimony, and by not challenging the Pulisano rulings and whatnot, the issue is whether, with the trial as it developed, and it is, just as the prosecutor said, it's an extraordinary case. But it's not one of those extraordinary cases that merits a retrial in the interests of justice, because a retrial with the grandfather's testimony will be chaotic, but will certainly arrive at the same result. Now, I understand you don't have to determine whether or not it will arrive at a different result. But I think the reality is that the real controversy of this child's testimony was fully tried. And I know Mr. Burns relies very heavily on the Weiss decision of the Court of Appeals, and that's very superficially appealing. However, there are actually two major differences in Weiss. The prosecutor had evidence that he knew was patently false. The prosecutor argued that the defendant never denied to the police that the assault occurred until the day of trial, when he knew he had police reports in his hand saying that he did on the day of the arrest. But more importantly, the defendant and Weiss testified at his trial. Mr. Burns did not testify at this trial. So in that case, the real controversy revolved around not only the credibility of the victim's accusations, but the credibility of the defendant's testimony. And that rebuttal argument followed the defendant's specific testimony on the witness stand. Mr. Weiss got up and said, yes, I did deny it to the police when I was arrested. And the prosecutor got up in rebuttal and said, no, he didn't. There's no evidence that he did, and he didn't put it in his written statement, knowing that was patently false. And so that not only bolstered victim's credibility in that case, but more importantly, it demolished the defendant's testimony. And I would suggest that many of the interests of justice cases that we see, where reversals occur, where there's a direct challenge to a prosecutor's improper argument and there's a reversal, many of those involve situations where a defendant does testify and the improper argument goes directly to the defendant's credibility. And
counsel, I want to jump in, if I may. And one of the things touched upon earlier in questioning referenced kind of what's a circuit court judge to do. that is, you don't want to have a trial within a trial. The circuit court judge here did not allow the testimony regarding the grandfather sexually assaulting the child. And as a result of that ruling, we have a record that some would suggest doesn't meet with reality. But at the subsequent trial, the trial of the grandfather, there was testimony, there was the information imparted regarding the sexual conduct of the uncle. If this case were retried, wouldn't you be in the same, you would relieve the trial court judge of this quandary of what to do with testimony of the, about the grandfather's assault because he hadn't been convicted. If it were retried, he would be convicted. That is, the grandfather would have been convicted before he got on the stand. And it's that tension about what to do with the rape shield law and a grandfather who gets on the stand and says she's lying, a record that suggests that the victim's conduct is consistent with a sexual assault victim, but as the prosecutor indicates, there is no other thing that went on in her life at that period of time that would explain those behaviors. No, there's a little craziness in all of this stuff because it doesn't meet with reality. The subsequent trial seemed to meet with reality without confusion. What's wrong with the retrial?
Well, what's wrong with it is that, as I tried to point out, the controversy about her credibility was fully explored here, in my view. And that is the issue for this court. The credibility of her allegations was fully explored. Now, and I think the Court of Appeals is very meticulous in explaining why getting into the grandfather's assaults in this case really doesn't add much to the picture and might create confusion. That, okay, so you asked Dr. Huebner, could someone else have sexually assaulted her? Sure. Could another relative have sexually assaulted her? Sure. Could that person, therefore, have been the one who sexually assaulted her and not Alan? Sure. And then the prosecutor gets up and says, but both of them could have sexually assaulted her. Sure. And her behavior is consistent with sexual assaults by both, including Alan. Sure. That's where you'd be, and yet you'd have several more days of testimony about the grandfather being held on a probable cause bind over, and then having the victim get up and explain that, as she did at the grandfather's trial, really what I told my friend in May of 2005 was that I lost my virginity to both of these men. I'm not sure which one. And that, and that the friend would then get up and say, that's right, that's exactly what she told me. I think what your quandary is really that when you're dealing with the rape shield law, it creates these problems, and sometimes it takes us out of the reality. That sometimes
takes
this stuff.
Takes us out of truth.
Well, but, you know, sometimes this stuff is probative, and yet it's not admissible under the rape shield law.
Let me, if I may, touch upon, for me, what's one of the more difficult things in this case. Because cases during the trial ebb and flow and make evidentiary rulings as a judge. But one of the things that concerns me is that comment by the prosecutor in rebuttal, that there's no other thing that went on in her life at that period of time that would explain those behaviors. That's false. And what do we do with that?
Well, it's, and I think the Court of Appeals in paragraph 37 says, yeah, it, it's technically true because it's tied to the evidence, but it's a misleading inference.
Well,
but then,
I beg to differ with the Court of Appeals. As, you know, they see it a little differently. When I read that, that in context, it says, no one can suggest a reason, again, as to why she was displaying the behaviors that she was, that Dr. Huebner talked about as being consistent with that of someone who was sexually assaulted. There's no other thing that went on in her life at that period of time that would explain those behaviors. I just see that as a false statement.
Well, I mean, you know, whether it's a false statement or a false inference that he's asking them to draw from that evidence, yes, I will agree that it's, and I agree with the Court of Appeals, that it's at least misleading in that sense. However, what's the impact on the real controversy? And again, you have to look at that comment in the context of the other rulings, but also in the context of the evidence that actually came into the trial, including not only the effective cross-examination of the victim, but also the grandfather's testimony, which now would no longer be available. And that even if there were an objection, and if there were a motion for a mistrial, and the judge says, no, I'll craft a curative instruction to the effect that there was another explanation, the grandfather's been charged, you still have the argument, okay, then she was sexually assaulted by both. And
Isn't that a jury question, and that was never presented to the jury?
But
the jury was presented with a 14-year-old and only one man in her life.
Well,
what the jury
was presented with a 14-year-old, from the defense point of view at least, with no man in her life. And that,
that's right. It's no or one.
Well, it's, you know, either she's, you know, you know, there's no issue here of confusion or whatnot. It's the defense was that she was lying about Alan sexually assaulting her. And I keep going back to the, if you put in proof that both of them sexually assaulted her, why does that disprove, why, you know, absent any motive for her to falsely, to truthfully accuse the grandfather and falsely accuse Alan, you know, how much does that add to the controversy? And, you know, in the reply brief, the first page of the reply brief, Mr. Burns says that, you know, the issue is really simple, which is the grandfather sexually assaulted the complainant. She acted out in ways that are consistent in a sexual assault victim, but Mr. Burns, the younger, did not assault her. Why? There's no explanation. And her falsely recusing him is one of her symptoms. Well, that's something that could have been explored with Huebner, but there was no request to do that. And I would also point out that's an issue that's raised for the first time in this court, this last idea that this was one of her behavioral symptoms. That's not argued in the Court of Appeals. That was not argued in the trial court. The argument below was that, well, there's an alternative explanation for her sexual knowledge. It was the grandfather.
Do we care whether it was argued below and it's argued here? Because we have the right of our own discretion. We can review the Court of Appeals, but we can exercise our own discretion. So whatever is presented here should be good enough.
Well, I mean, I think I certainly would not suggest that what – yes, you have that authority, but I would,
right.
I would hasten to add that what happened below is not irrelevant because it shows how the issue was framed.
Oh, I agree with that. I also want to know how many times does the defendant have to and in how many ways does the defendant have to keep saying, I want to bring in the grandfather. I want to bring in the – when I say bring in the grandfather, I mean the facts about the grandfather. It was done a number of times.
Well,
after a while, you don't have to keep making that objection. You have to the trial court's rules, and we have cases that say that. You don't have to keep making the same objection every time. Isn't that right?
But this would have been an entirely different objection when Dr. Huebner took the stand. It's no longer pretrial. He wanted to cross-examine her about her many different statements just to show prior inconsistent statements, including that she was a virgin and she really wasn't. Well, that's a blatant violation of the rape shield law. Then he wanted to get into the hymenal tears to show that the grandfather did sexually assault her and not Alan. And the judge said, if the state gets into that, yes, you can do that. So, but the state didn't get into that, and so he didn't. But now
Huber. Mr. O'Brien, paragraph 3 of the Court of Appeals decision indicates that Burns wanted to question SB on the evidence of the tears.
I didn't hear you. He wanted to.
I said, according to the Court of Appeals, Burns wanted to question SB on the tears and view that with the evidence of her allegations against her grandfather.
That's
and
right.
And that he asserted it came within the rape shield law because it showed the source of injury. And that the court ruled against him. Then later on in the Court of Appeals decision, it says, okay, the state now wanted to bring it in. And then the court did what you said it did. So well, both of them wanted to bring it in under different...
Well, it was the state's evidence. And initially, Burns raised the issue to say, I'd like to... And I think he was operating on the assumption the state was going to introduce it. And he said, I want to be able to argue that the grandfather did it. And then the prosecutor said, well, if that's the choice, I'm not going to introduce it. And then the judge, I'd like to introduce it, but I'm not going to. And the judge said, and I think these were over two separate hearings, if I recall correctly, the judge said, all right, if the state introduces it, I will allow you to ask whether those tears were caused by the grandfather. However, if the state does not introduce it, I'm not going to let you introduce it. I think that's where we got. And then the trial proceeds. There's no more discussion of the admissibility of the grandfather's evidence until, well, then we get to Dr. Huebner, and it would seem to me that if that is the point, if you want to get in evidence that her allegations against Alan are symptomatic of the abuse that we all agree was caused by the grandfather, that is the time to raise that objection, to ask the trial judge, can I cross-examine her at least about that? And that was never done here, even though he knew that she was going to give testimony which would support, if not the prosecutor's argument, certainly the inference, even without the prosecutor's argument, that there's no other explanation than that she was sexually assaulted by someone. And so as the Court of Appeals said, the prosecutor, with or without that prosecutor's argument, the jury could infer that there's no other explanation. So the point where you raise that issue is when Dr. Huebner testified. That wasn't raised. There's no claim that it should have been raised. There's no claim that counsel was ineffective for not raising it at that point.
I don't think
that would have been a futile objection. It might have not have succeeded, but I think it was an entirely different objection than the ones that were raised several days earlier.
How would you suggest the court write the opinion?
Well, to be honest with you, I thought the Court of Appeals did a real fine job. But I would suggest that I'm not being flippant there. I think that they seriously analyzed the evidence. They weighed everything. They understood the strictures that were both parties were under. They understood that Mr. Burns' counsel had to make lemonade out of lemons, and he did a pretty good job of it, I might suggest, with the grandfather's unrebutted testimony. And, you know, again, that's another point I would, just as an aside, Mr. Burns did not testify here. The only witness he had to directly challenge her credibility was the grandfather. There was nobody else. Although he did also draw some inconsistencies through other state's witnesses, but the main defense witness. So, you know, if we're going to retry this case, then either there's no defense witness challenging her credibility, or Alan Burns has to take the stand, and believe me, he's going to face some very severe cross-examination. So how do you write it? I think the real controversy is whether SB's credibility was fully and fairly challenged at this trial, despite the peculiarities and the strictures that occurred. And I think in light of the evidence presented, in light of the effective cross-examination that was done, in light of the ability to put the grandfather on in this unique situation and it directly attacked his loving granddaughter's credibility, not only her general credibility, but on very specific issues, like did he ever confront both of them about this? Did he ever ask Alan about this? Did he ever ask her about this? And he said, no, this never came up. So, and the ability to put the girlfriend on to defeat one of the counts, and the opportunity that he didn't utilize to get into this with Dr. Humer, I think all shows that the real controversy regarding her credibility, again, in a case where his credibility is not an issue, it's her credibility, was it sufficiently attacked? Were prior inconsistent statements brought out? Was inconsistent testimony brought out? Was there a family witness to directly challenge her credibility? The answer to all that is yes. And I think in light of that, that this court should affirm the Court of Appeals.
But could I ask you, in looking back on all that happened, did Judge Lina Weber make any incorrect rulings with respect to the rape shield law?
I think certainly on the virginity stuff and in the pretrial stage where they only wanted to get into this stuff to attack her credibility, not to prove that someone else did it. At that point, they weren't sure. And so I think that's a violation of the rape shield law. That gets you to the Pulisano issue. And I think that's a debatable point. I think, again, the 90403 issues are a legitimate concern here on balance with what probative value this stuff would have had as far as showing, yes, she was sexually assaulted by the grandfather. Does that necessarily mean she wasn't sexually assaulted by Alan? Are we going to spend 3 days of testimony getting into that? And so I think he was correct on the rape shield law. I think his ruling on the Pulisano issue is defensible. I understand at least my understanding is that it's subject to independent review, although I find that kind of challenging when you're dealing with a 90403 balancing. But I think that at the very least his rulings are defensible. There's no challenge to his ruling in allowing Dr. Huebner to testify, as I've pointed out at length here. I think that those underlying rulings are correct, even though, yes, they created some very acute difficulties for both sides here. And I'm not going to deny that. And yet within those strictures, there was a legitimate, thorough, sound challenge to this victim's credibility that was brought out before this jury.
Are you familiar with the case that was argued yesterday about credibility in a sexual assault case?
I have to admit that I'm not. I think I read a brief summary of it, but off the top of my head, I wouldn't be able to comment on it.
Because there, the state's position was the credibility of the sexual assault victim, who was a younger child, much younger than this child, that to bolster that credibility, which the state needed credibility, you could bring in other act evidence of the defendant that were not similar at all. That it was a broad view of bringing in evidence on credibility. And it strikes me that in this case, the state doesn't want to let the defendant bring in broad evidence on credibility. Now, it's not other acts evidence of the defendant. It's acts of somebody else, which does not disprove the defendant's conduct. It just raises an issue about the credibility, which you keep saying.
That's the issue you always face in a rape shield case.
Right. It's an issue you always face in sexual assault because it's rare that you have any other witness other than the alleged perpetrator and the victim.
Right. And, am I arguing that the defense shouldn't have been allowed to introduce this evidence? I answered in response to Justice Prosser's question, I'm saying that it was properly not allowed to introduce this. But, despite that, It's our position that the real controversy about her credibility was fully tried.
Is there anything about this trial that bothers you? Anything that bothers the state, even if you don't think it's enough to upset the verdict? Anything that bothers you as the state?
Well, I'll agree with the Court of Appeals that that inference should not have been drawn.
Which inference are you talking about?
That there's no other explanation for her behavior. I'll agree that I'm uncomfortable with that inference being asked for, even though, as the Court of Appeals correctly recognized, that inference would have likely been drawn by the jury even without the argument. I'm not comfortable with that argument. I'll go with that. As far as the rigidity, her blurting out
that
the rigidity.
That inference had to come as soon as the grandfather was excluded. And witness was allowed.
But that would have been the point to say, well, Judge, then I should be allowed to ask Dr. Huebner in her expert opinion.
You rely on the fact that the defendant didn't make that objection and therefore forfeited it and therefore doesn't count for us.
It's way beyond that. They don't pursue that at all here.
Right. Okay.
I mean, regardless of whether the prosecutor made that argument, I don't think it might be a strategy reason for all we know, as far as why the defense attorney didn't get into it. We still know because there's no challenge to his effectiveness. I see that my red light is on, so unless there are any more questions, I'll conclude.
Thank you, and you may conclude unless there are other questions. Thank you, Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you.
Mr. Karp, you have 5 minutes, and according to the clock on that wall, there are about 7 minutes remaining before 11 o'clock. And the reason I stress that is because at 11, on the first Wednesday of every month, the fire alarms are tested. So it's important you stay within 5 minutes because the noise is so horrendous, no one can stand it.
I'll
and you can't talk over it, okay? 5 minutes. Go.
Panagar, we have a situation where, again, the defendant attempted to use the complainant's testimony about her lack of sexual experience to his advantage. Chief Justice, you wrote, I believe, we do not agree with the prosecution, however, that the defendant's use of the complainant's testimony about her lack of prior experience should prevent the court from reversing the conviction. In other words, so even though there can be, even though the defense makes lemonade out of lemons, it doesn't remove the sting. I'm also going to signal to Daggett, California case, which I cited in my brief at page 27, very similar situation where the complainant was accused of assaulting other children, a possible sign of having herself been assaulted, and the prosecutor in that case argued the only explanation for the complainant's behavior was that the defendant assaulted the complainant. The California court reversed, saying the prosecutor unfairly took advantage of the judge's ruling. Vigorous advocacy is admirable, but when it turns into a zeal to convict at all costs, it perverts rather than promotes justice. And that's what happened here. Arguing this on rebuttal was just unfair. The defense really couldn't answer it.
Counsel, if you didn't have the prosecutor's statement on rebuttal, do you believe you'd have a sufficient case for a retrial?
I think the most harmful thing in this case from the defense point of view is the statement of the prosecutor.
Question was, if just say you blanked that out, if you didn't have that, would you have enough in your view for a retrial?
That's really hard to answer. I'm looking at the total picture. I mean, what the analysis the Court of Appeals took is, okay, we're going to take point A, point B, point C, break them down. Oh, each one is weak. And maybe that's so, but if you put them together, they're not so weak. If you put them together, it shows an injustice was done. And that's what I'm arguing. The Huebner testimony, okay, could the, Dr. Huebner couldn't possibly testify as to who had assaulted the complainant, other than to say that she was consistent with a family member. We only have one family member being accused before the jury. The jury hears about the petitioner and doesn't hear about grandpa. They can't possibly draw the inference. And again, the petitioner doesn't have to prove he's innocent. He's presumed innocent.
Although, counsel, with all due respect, but for the prosecutor's remarks, and assume you get all of this in, you get the tears in, you get the grandfather's assault in, no matter how you slice it, it still comes down to who the jury believes. Do they believe her when she says he sexually assaulted me, or do they believe that she's untruthful? That's it. So, but for the prosecutor's remarks, you don't have the strength of your argument, because even if everything went your way, you got to introduce everything you ever wanted to. Unfortunately, just because one family member sexually assaults a person doesn't mean that another didn't. I mean, I've tried a number of those cases, and there are a lot of serial family member sexual assaults. So the trial court judge has to figure out, how do I put this before the jury so they're deciding if this defendant did this action and if the state has met its burden of proof. So you try to hone the issue so the jury is called upon to decide that which is before these charges. Not other charges, not the grandfather, nothing else, just did this person did. So, but for the prosecutor's remarks, no matter whether the trial court let everything in or tried it just the exact same way, it strikes me that that deeply and profoundly affects your situation here today.
Siegel, I don't know that I agree. But it happened. We can't deny that it happened. But again, to take each element and break it down is not the way to proceed when you're talking about interests of justice. And again, the petitioner was presumed innocent. He didn't have to testify. He didn't have to let the jury hear about his prior convictions. He doesn't have to prove he's innocent.
That's right.
All the defense has to do is create reasonable doubt. Even with Huebner's testimony, you present evidence that, okay, Grandpa Keith assaulted her. All right, the jury could have a reasonable doubt that the petitioner was guilty. That's all that has to be reached here, and that's what the defense position would be. So I would respectfully ask the court to reverse in the interest of justice.
Thank you.
And you not only gave a good argument, but you finished timely. Thank you, Mr. Karp, and thank you, Mr. O'Brien, for a very interesting argument relating to interest of justice and cumulative effect of what you view as errors or at least dubious evidence and dubious statements. And that concludes our argument on 09-AP-118-CR, State v. Burns. The court will be in recess to let the other students in, and if these students wish to leave, they may, and we'll come back after the alarm is completed. We're in recess.